This episode features discussion of violence that some people may find offensive. Listener discretion is advised.
September 1st, 2010. 32-year-old Melissa Shepherd sighed as she sat down in the large conference room at Discovery Communications. Beyond the glass walls, the rest of the office was humming industriously.
Discovery was home to a number of family-friendly networks, including the Discovery Channel, Animal Planet, and TLC. The media conglomerate also employed 1,900 employees, plus a few contractors. Melissa was among the latter group.
She had built a successful career as a business consultant. Huge clients like Discovery would fly her in from New Hampshire to do work for them.
It was an exciting time in Melissa's career, but today she was feeling a bit tired. As the meeting wore on, she found herself looking forward to her comfortable hotel room.
An overhead announcement sent a sharp jolt through everyone in the conference room. There was a disturbance in the building's lobby. Everyone needed to stay at their desks.
Terrified, Melissa followed her colleagues as they rushed into a nearby office. They locked the door, turned off the lights, and huddled together on the ground.
A few minutes passed, and there was a knock on the door. They were being told to move upstairs. Or was it downstairs? The instructions weren't clear, and Melissa was shaking from the stress.
Frustrated, she screamed, "Tell us where we need to go."
She had no idea that the intruder downstairs was riddled with bombs.
This is Hostage, a Parcast original. Every week, we tell the stories behind the most captivating hostage situations and the people inside them.
We'll also cover the psychological tactics used in kidnapping situations and what the human brain does when held captive.
I'm Irma Blanco.
And I'm Carter Roy.
You can find episodes of Hostage and all other Parcast originals for free on Spotify or wherever you listen to podcasts. To stream Hostage for free on Spotify, just open the app and type Hostage in the search bar.
At Parcast, we're grateful for you, our listeners. You allow us to do what we love. Let us know how we're doing. Reach out on Facebook and Instagram at Parcast and Twitter at Parcast Network.
And if you enjoyed today's episode, the best way to help us is to leave a 5-star review wherever you're listening. It really does help.
This week, we're doing a single episode on the hostage situation that took place at the Discovery Communications building in Silver Spring, Maryland.
On September 1st, 2010, 43-year-old radical environmentalist James J. Lee charged the lobby of the media company's headquarters. He had several makeshift bombs strapped to his torso and warned that he was ready to explode.
In the ensuing hours, Lee held 3 employees hostage at gunpoint. Police would try desperately to negotiate with Lee, who wouldn't rest until Discovery executed his demands for environmental programming.
San Diego, 2007. 40-year-old James J. Lee sat in the quiet coffee shop inside a local Borders bookstore. On the table in front of him lay several stacks of $1 bills.
One of the baristas, Randy Kindle, glanced up from behind the glossy counter. He eyed Lee's familiar face quizzically. This wasn't the first time the middle-aged man had done this.
For the past few weeks, Lee had made the bookstore his haunt. He always paid for his coffee and tipped handsomely before taking his usual seat at a nearby table. Then he would reach into his pockets, take out the wads of money, and display them on the table for all to see.
Randy couldn't figure it out. Why bring so much cash to a coffee shop? And why set it out on the table? What was Lee up to?
He decided that today was a good day as any to find out. Smiling, Randy walked over to Lee and gestured towards the money. He casually asked what Lee was doing.
Lee glanced up, an eager look in his eyes. Clearly, he had been waiting for someone to ask him this question. He told Randy that the stacks of cash each amounted to $100. And he was giving them away to anyone who had read a book by Daniel Quinn, the American author and cultural critic.
Randy shook his head. He'd never read Quinn's books. But Lee seemed prepared for this answer, and he was more than ready to educate Randy.
According to Lee, Quinn was a truth teller. His books laid out how humans are wrecking the environment and the necessary steps that must be taken to save the planet from imminent doom.
Randy would later recall that Lee seemed intelligent, if not a little deluded by his own certainty. Nonetheless, he went home and read one of Quinn's books himself. He later told Lee that he had read the book, but didn't exactly agree with it.
Lee took the criticism in perfect stride, and as promised, he gave Randy $100. He was happy to have an audience, and he hoped that the book would eventually sink in with Randy. After all, it predicted the end of the world. Little is known about James J. Lee's early life. He was raised in Hawaii, and his family was wealthy enough to leave him an inheritance of both cash and some commercial island property.
Most of Lee's life was fairly unremarkable, but a turning point came around 2002 when Lee was 35 years old. According to his sister-in-law, two unnamed people close to Lee died that year. The tragedies sent him into a spiral of anger and emotion from which he never seemed to recover. And it ultimately seemed to affect his relationship to the world around him, even those he loved. As Lee's sister-in-law would later recall, Lee had a normal relationship with people before 2002, but after that, he was completely different.
Shortly after the deaths in 2002, Lee disappeared. For the next 8 years of his life, his family had no idea where he was. They constantly wondered if he was okay. Lee's brother-in-law, Thomas Leonard, would later remember Lee as an unstable person. He was susceptible to emotional outbursts and erratic behavior.
Leonard also described Lee as someone who lacked respect for authority, a trait which first got him in trouble in 2003.
In August 2003, Lee was sentenced to 18 months in prison for attempting to smuggle an immigrant across the U.S. border from Mexico. The woman had been concealed in a hidden compartment of Lee's car as he attempted to cross from Tijuana into San Ysidro, California.
According to Lee, he had been forced into this occupation. He claimed that he had been on a trip to Tijuana when armed gunmen charged into his hotel room. They allegedly choked and robbed him before offering him a job transporting illegal immigrants.
However, following his arrest, Lee told the judge that smuggling was the only period in his life when he had actually felt good about himself. Lee said, "I have never saved a person's life, but it felt the same as I imagined it would have felt. For once, my life seemed to actually benefit the lives of others."
Lee also told the judge that his whole life had been a living, breathing nightmare. And he lamented that after prison, he would undoubtedly be the same person as he had been before, wishing he could magically trade places with someone else.
Lee appears to have remained in California for a couple of years following his release from prison in 2004. It was during this time that he began spending a lot of time at the local Borders bookstore in San Diego. It was there in 2006 that an employee recommended he read the author Daniel Quinn. She suggested starting with Quinn's masterpiece, a book titled Ishmael.
Daniel Quinn was a celebrated author before his death in 2018. In his writings, he philosophized about humanity's false sense of importance and the harm that people are wreaking on the environment. His award-winning series, Ishmael and My Ishmael, are both written from the perspective of a telepathic gorilla who educates his students about environmental decline.
Reading these books proved to be a transformative experience for James J. Lee. In them, he found a cause worth championing, something to mold into his personal vocation. As soon as he had finished the last page of Ishmael, Lee was wholly convinced that he needed to become an environmental activist immediately.
Within a week, Lee reached out to Mike Thayer, a member of a local message board called SD Ishmael. Lee wanted to start a weekly in-person meeting with other members of the group to discuss Quinn's writings. Lee ended the email with an urgent note saying, "Let's do it. Let's do this now."
Although the weekly meetings never materialized, Lee was added to the online group, where he quickly became its most active member. He and other members would vaguely discuss an idea for a utopian society where they would live in close keeping with the environment in an effort to protect it.
At one point, Lee wrote that he was planning to pay for the utopia's creation with his own family inheritance, but this scheme never fully formed.
Dr. Chester L. Quarles, an international criminal justice expert, remarks on the incentives of seemingly normal people who become terrorists with delusions that they can change the world. He says, "In belonging to this new group, he matters to someone, and he now has status that perhaps he has never felt before. He has a strong sense of identity to a purpose, a task, and a cause."
Having experienced so much unhappiness in his life, Lee was primed for his new obsession. It was a cause he could finally devote his life to. He never wanted to turn his back on it, even if it led him to death's door. By 2007, Lee had been laid off from his job at a factory in San Diego. He shifted all of his attention to environmental activism. And it was around this time that he finally fixated on an antagonist for his radical beliefs: Discovery Communications.
Discovery Communications is home to a variety of television networks, including Discovery Channel, Science Channel, Animal Planet, and TLC. These family-friendly networks provide a range of shows that many Americans consider to be wholesome entertainment. But for Lee, they were anything but.
In his mind, Discovery had the biggest platform in America to enact positive social and climate change, and Lee didn't think that they were going about it the correct way at all.
For one, he despised their celebration of large families. Discovery's TLC channel in particular boasted a variety of reality shows, with titles such as John and Kate Plus 8, Table for 12, and 19 Kids and Counting. Each one offered an intimate glimpse into the lives of big, boisterous families.
Lee hated how these programs glamorized procreation, which he viewed as environmental evil. In fact, he believed Discovery Communications should be promoting the opposite. He wanted to see the shows push anti-population solutions like sterilization and infertility to combat what he considered to be parasitic human infants and human pollution.
This was the birth of Lee's antinatalist views, which would continue to permeate his speech throughout the remainder of his life. He believed that giving birth to humans was an evil in itself because of the impact of overpopulation on the Earth's natural resources.
This worldview began to bleed into other areas of Lee's personal opinions. In sharp contrast to his smuggling days, he even began to condemn immigration. He believed that the rapidly procreating third world was being sustained by the first world and that it needed to be cut off from all assistance. In Lee's mind, immigrant children were, quote, anchor baby filth. And he wanted the Discovery Networks to educate the U.S. on the environmental importance of border control.
Above all, Lee wanted Discovery to broadcast the ideals laid out by his favorite author, Daniel Quinn. He believed wholeheartedly that solutions like tribalism, decreased technology, and population control were viable.
To some, Lee's basic concerns could be considered pure. After all, he was worried about the Earth and sustainability, and many scientists would agree with him regarding the toll of the population on natural resources. However, Lee's rancorous regard for the human race indicated that deeper problems were brewing.
This underlying hatred was exacerbated by his own delusional dreams. Over time, Lee seemed to develop a messiah complex. He truly believed that he could convince a multi-billion-dollar company to bow to his precise demands.
Dr. Stephen Diamond, a clinical and forensic psychologist, discusses these delusions of grandeur. He says, When one has been chronically frustrated in realizing their positive, creative potentiality, it remains stillborn in the unconscious, disassociated from the personality, rendering them highly susceptible to possession by the Messiah complex.
This seemed to be the case with Lee, who had felt frustrated and impotent all his life. Having finally found his identity in a just cause, he developed an irrational belief in his own abilities. He sincerely thought it was within his power to change an entire corporation and save the environment.
With this misguided confidence, Lee was ready to take his activism to the streets. By January 2008, he had moved across the country to be near Silver Spring, Maryland, home of the Discovery Communications headquarters.
Lee was eager to begin his protest against the media conglomerate. But it was only a matter of time before his wrath took a deadly turn.
Up next, Lee storms Discovery Communications. Now back to the story. In 2008, 41-year-old environmental activist James J. Lee had recently moved across the country to Silver Spring, Maryland. His sights were set on the 10-story Discovery Communications headquarters, which had become the target of his vitriol.
In Lee's mind, Discovery wasn't effectively harnessing their platform to save the planet from environmental disaster. Someone needed to hold the company accountable, and Lee was determined to be that person.
Lee's protest began innocently enough by picketing in front of the Discovery Communications building in downtown Silver Spring. He carried signs that said, "Save the Planet, Discovery Channel," and he sometimes paid homeless people to help him protest. He was eventually arrested for disorderly conduct and sentenced to 46 days in jail.
Not long after his release, Lee was back to demonstrating in front of the building. On February 21st, 2008, he drew a crowd by throwing fistfuls of his own money into the air.
The cash totaled around $20,000 and was likely taken from Lee's own inheritance. It was supposed to represent the corporate greed of Discovery's executives. By treating his money like garbage, Lee hoped to demonstrate the superficiality of wealth in the face of greater environmental concerns.
As Lee tossed it around, a small group of about 100 people gathered to watch. Lee enthusiastically explained what he was doing, and he encouraged the onlookers to participate. According to him, the money was just trash.
Lee was arrested on the spot for littering. The judge acquitted him with a $500 fee and a mandatory psychiatric evaluation, which came back clean. Lee quickly returned to his activism.
In early 2008, Lee set up a new website for his cause, SaveThePlanetProtest.com, where he frequently advertised his demonstrations. He announced that he would be discussing the writings of Daniel Quinn, the cultural critic and author, and he expressed a desire for people to collaborate on ideas for saving the planet and living sustainably. It was a nice enough thought, but in his protests, Lee seemed to tightly control the narrative. He was more focused on getting people to agree with him than actually collaborating on ideas.
In one instance, Lee stood in front of Discovery with a duffel bag full of money. He told passerbys that he would give them money for coming up with a good idea for a new Discovery Channel show, but it had to be within his own parameters. Lee specifically wanted the show to highlight lowland gorillas in Central Africa. Participants were given paper to write down their proposals, and Lee handed out varying amounts of $10 and $20 bills for his favorite ideas.
Discovery paid no heed to these demonstrations. Nonetheless, on Lee's website, he claimed that he would continue to pressure the company until they gave in to his rigid demands. From mid-2008 onward, Lee seemed to crawl back into the hole where he was living. By 2010, he had rented a room in the nearby D.C. suburb of Wheaton. Neighbors would later say he was always wearing a baseball hat and a jumpsuit, the same industrial outfit he had worn during his protests.
Around this time, Lee also created his own reality show treatment, which he emailed to Discovery. He titled it Race to Save the Planet, and he described how contestants would battle each other for the best ideas to implement.
Lee also posted a contest on his website. He promised $10,000 in cash plus part of his real estate property in Hawaii to whichever contestant had the best idea for an environmental show. But it had to be based on a Daniel Quinn book. It remains unknown whether Lee received any submissions.
In spite of these efforts, Lee remained completely unnoticed by the top floor of Discovery Communications. While many of the 1,900 employees had heard of him or seen his face outside, no one had engaged with him on a serious level, and none of his demands were being met.
By September 2010, Lee had spent nearly 2 years of his life protesting. He had been estranged from his family for nearly 8 years and had little, if any, contact with his acquaintances in San Diego.
Alone and frustrated, James J. Lee finally snapped. No one knows for sure how long he had been premeditating a drastic standoff with Discovery, but all of Lee's frustration seemed to finally climax that year, beginning with his personal manifesto.
Lee published the manifesto on his website for all to see. It combined all of his grievances into a scathing and sometimes inarticulate rant. Using his unusual, spiteful metaphors for humans and immigrants, Lee reiterated his hatred of Discovery's programming, and he made his final case for broadcasting the writings of Daniel Quinn, writing in all capital letters, "Make it interesting."
But the manifesto was just the beginning. Next, Lee turned his thoughts toward a drastic plan of action. It was time to save the planet. Or die trying. On September 1st, 2010, James J. Lee strapped metallic canisters to the front and back of his torso. They were homemade bombs made from propane cylinders.
In his arms, he held two boxes and two backpacks that were also filled with explosives. In his pocket was a starter pistol.
Starter pistols are a type of gun that only shoot blanks, never bullets. They're typically used in horse races and other competitions, but they look just like any other gun. And in the hands of a bomb-riddled terrorist, they always appear real.
With these sinister accoutrements, Lee made his way to the Discovery Communications headquarters. It was time to take his last stand.
When Lee arrived near the 10-story Discovery building, the atmosphere was cheery. So far, it had been a normal day for the company's small ecosystem. Many of its 1,900 employees were just coming back from their lunch breaks.
Down on the first floor, children were still in daycare at Discovery Kids Place, a complimentary service offered to employee families.
Small children were busy playing with toys and coloring. Nursery workers were putting babies in their cribs for naps. No one had any sense of the danger that was about to take place.
At around 1 p.m., Lee burst into the lobby, brandishing a gun. The people around him shrieked in terror.
Men and women in business suits fled in every direction. Lee shouted for everyone to stay still.
As the lobby emptied, two male employees flattened themselves against the cold tile, hands over their heads. Lee aimed his gun at them as he slowly inched over to a third man, the building security guard.
Lee grabbed the guard and pulled him next to his side as he continued to yell at the hostages on the floor. He pointed his gun at one head and then the other. No one made a noise.
Ari Fisher, a project manager, had just finished grabbing lunch when he returned to work. Sensing a strange atmosphere around the building, he peered through the tinted glass and into the lobby.
Ari could vaguely see what looked like a man holding on to another man. At least two people were lying on the floor. Startled, Ari quickly fled the premises. Meanwhile, an email circulated to everyone in the building. It said, "We have reason to believe there is an armed gunman at one Discovery place. All employees should seek protection in a locked office on their respective floors immediately.
Adam Dolan, a 28-year-old sales director, was preparing to head downstairs to grab a late lunch. But as he proceeded to the elevator, another employee grabbed him. She told Adam about the email, warning him not to go downstairs. Instead, Adam headed to the top floor, found an office, and locked himself inside.
Before long, an announcement flooded to the upper floors of the Discovery Building, telling everyone to find safety. Anyone who hadn't read the email or heard the news was immediately on the alert.
Employees and visitors alike dove into the nearest office rooms and locked the doors. Lights were turned out across the floors.
As they huddled in their respective hiding places, no one seemed to have any details on the situation. They were just praying they would be spared.
Down in the lobby, James J. Lee continued to hang on to the security guard as he aimed his gun at the hostages on the floor. He was just waiting for the chance to make his demands, and he wouldn't have to wait much longer.
Within minutes of Lee storming the building, the Montgomery County Police Department responded. Police Chief J. Thomas Manger and his squad swarmed outside the building, followed closely by teams from the FBI, ATF, and SWAT.
The SWAT team sealed off all the roads surrounding the building as crowds of people emptied out of nearby office complexes. The bystanders fled across the street, trying to get as far away as possible from whatever was happening.
Despite the uncertainty, the responding officers knew they had to act fast. Margaret Wilson, a forensic psychologist, emphasizes the importance of these first few minutes in a hostage crisis. She says, the early moments are the stage that injuries and fatalities within the hostage group are most likely to occur at the hands of the hostage takers.
Police Chief Manger knew how crucial these first few minutes were. He and the authorities worked quickly to control the situation outside. Then they received a call from NBC. One of the channel's producers had called Discovery's front desk, and Lee had answered the phone.
Chief Manger secretly listened in on the call. Lee identified himself and issued a stern warning not to do anything rash. He said, I have several bombs strapped to my body, ready to go off.
Chief Manger looked at the other officials. Their worst fears had been confirmed. Up next, Lee's standoff with the police turns deadly. Now back to the story.
It was a sunny afternoon on Wednesday, September 1st, 2010, but the sidewalks of downtown Silver Spring, Maryland were completely silent. Police cars lined the streets. SWAT snipers crouched inside nearby buildings. Everyone's sights were set on one building, the 10-story Discovery Communications headquarters.
Inside the first floor lobby, 43-year-old radical environmentalist James J. Lee was laced with homemade bombs. He was holding two Discovery employees and a security guard hostage at gunpoint.
Lee had just gotten off the phone with a producer from NBC News. He told the man he would blow up the building if Discovery's media executives didn't bow to his demands fast.
Almost immediately after Lee hung up, the lobby's front desk phone rang again. This time, it was Police Chief J. Thomas Manger and several other hostage experts. Lee was more than ready to talk. His entire purpose was to get people to listen to his stringent demands.
He directed them to his website, SaveThePlanetProtest.com, where he had recently posted a manifesto. In it, Lee demanded that Discovery cancel all of its programming that showcased happy families. In their place, he wanted specific shows aimed at promoting sterilization and condemning immigration. He also tasked Discovery with finding solutions to large-scale problems like auto pollution, global warming, overpopulation, and environmental decline.
Lee also demanded a new show based on the writings of Daniel Quinn, his favorite author and cultural critic. He believed Quinn's books offered viable solutions to the environmental crisis, and he was determined to make Discovery broadcast these ideas across their channels.
As soon as Chief Manger and the other negotiators realized the extent of Lee's demands, they knew it was impossible to negotiate any sort of compromise. So they switched to a viable plan B, which was to keep him talking about his grandiose ideas.
Well, they understood the soothing power of listening, and they hoped to gradually talk Lee down from his emotional ledge. They also had an unprecedented advantage.
The security guard that Lee had taken hostage was a retired U.S. military officer. He had served in Iraq and was well-versed in handling volatile situations. To this day, he remains unidentified, but his role in the next few hours would be vital. Instead of using his experience to intimidate Lee, the retired officer played the part of a helpless mediator.
Psychiatrist Dr. Raj Prasad and Dr. Peter Bruggen discussed the usefulness of this approach. They said, appearing less powerful than you really are at crucial moments seems to have negotiation benefits, as it doesn't invoke a need to show strength from the other side. The security guard employed this strategy by leveraging his vulnerable position as a hostage. He remained gentle and calm in the situation, which allowed Lee to trust him enough to be the mediator. Meanwhile, the security guard used his position to soothe Lee while feeding updates to the authorities.
This was no small task for one man. Lee seemed to be at wit's end, ideologically as well as emotionally. After 2 years of working on a plan that only he seemed to care about, carrying out countless demonstrations and trying to incentivize others to join him, Lee was a shell of his former self.
The depth of his loneliness and despair was evident to Chief Manger and the rest of the authorities on the other end of the phone. One moment Lee would be completely calm, and the next he would be filled with hysterical rage. They needed to keep him as mellow as possible.
Meanwhile, experts were desperately trying to track down Lee's family. They searched his name and mined his website and inbox for clues, but they wouldn't be able to locate any of Lee's family members until it was too late.
In the upper floors of the Discovery Communications building, many of the company's 1,900 employees were crouched under their desks or locked inside small offices.
One group of employees huddled in a supply closet, texting their friends and family. One of the messages said, "There's a shooter here at Discovery. I am okay."
Other employees were less calm. One woman was crying.
Tears streamed down her face as her coworkers tried to convince her to stay put where they were hiding. She was worried about her toddler. Down on the first floor, just steps away from the lobby, was Discovery Kids Place. The daycare was filled with 100 small children and infants.
As the situation developed, Chief Manger and the authorities became even more worried about the children's safety. They had read Lee's antinatalist manifesto, which called babies human pollution. They couldn't risk him discovering the daycare.
Within the first half hour of the crisis, authorities helped daycare workers smash through a glass wall and wheel out four cribs filled with babies and toddlers. Rows of small children trailed behind as the group fled down the street to a nearby McDonald's. Eventually, the upstairs employees received instructions to evacuate through a stairwell in the back of the building.
At around 1:45, the first crowd of people poured out, followed by groups from other floors. They were instructed to collect their children at McDonald's and go home immediately. Chief Manger watched anxiously as they fled the scene. He was relieved to have made it this far, but there were still three hostages in the lobby.
Lee kept his starter gun trained on the two Discovery employees on the ground. Meanwhile, the security guard did his best to mediate between Lee and the police on the phone.
Hour after hour ticked by as Lee continued to make his demands, but he was becoming more exhausted. And as the minutes dragged on, he began revealing more and more of his personal misery.
Lee repeatedly told Chief Manger and the other negotiators that he was ready to die.
They began to worry that Lee would commit a murder-suicide. Either he would shoot the others and himself, or he would blow up the building.
Outside, SWAT snipers were in position. They were prepared to shoot through the tinted glass if Lee made any sudden moves.
At 4:48 p.m., nearly 4 hours into the standoff, one of the two employees on the lobby floor made a small movement. Startled, Lee shot his starter pistol at the man.
To everyone watching outside, it looked like a real gun had gone off. They couldn't risk Lee shooting at the hostages.
Immediately, one of the snipers pulled the trigger. The bullet pierced the glass wall of the lobby and struck Lee, causing one of the bombs on his torso to go off.
As the smoke cleared, the security guard and the two other hostages ran out of the building. They were completely safe. And Lee was dead.
Experts quickly sent in a robot to disarm the homemade bombs. In Lee's bags and boxes, they found another starter pistol and a ski mask.
Chief Manger would later say that Lee appeared to have planned to stay for as long as it took until his demands were met. If the one hostage hadn't made a sudden move, who knows how long the standoff might have lasted, or who would have survived.
Meanwhile, authorities had swarmed Lee's home in Wheaton, Maryland, where they found four other homemade bombs. These were safely detonated.
In the ensuing media buzz, Discovery Communications did their best to keep a handle on the narrative. David Levy, a spokesperson for the company, reported that safety measures were being increased for the building.
When reporters tried to approach their employees, they were quickly shut down. One person said they had been strictly instructed not to speak to the press about the incident.
When word reached Lee's family, they were grieved to hear about what their brother had done and about his death. But they also weren't surprised.
Lee's brother, Aaron, said, "I was sad to know that he was shot and killed, but that's probably what he wanted."
Lee's idol, author Daniel Quinn, was startled and upset by the news. He wished that he had had a chance to talk to Lee. Maybe then, things would have turned out different.
Thanks for tuning in to Hostage. You can find more episodes of Hostage and all other Parcast originals for free on Spotify.
Not only does Spotify already have all your favorite music, but now Spotify is making it easy for you to enjoy all your favorite Parcast originals, like Hostage, for free, from your phone, desktop, or smart speaker.
To stream Hostage on Spotify, just open the app and type Hostage in the search bar.
And don't forget to follow us on Facebook and Instagram at Parcast and Twitter at Parcast Network. We'll see you next time.
In the meantime, don't take your freedom for granted.
Hostage was created by Max Cutler and is a Parcast Studios original. Executive producers include Max and Ron Cutler. Sound design by Russell Nash, with production assistance by Ron Shapiro, Carly Madden, and Isabella Way. This episode of Hostage was written by Allie Wicker, with writing assistance by Maggie Admire, and stars Irma Blanco and Carter Roy.